Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue to learn, pray, and act. Don't need to embellish on, you know, the importance of that. And in addition, everything we're doing needs to be centered. We all need to agree that the entire scope of the Constitution must be complied to. Every offense must be opposed. Now, we may actually look and go, okay, are we, you know, what should we do regarding this little infraction? And it may be a single outlier. I'll give you a case in point. And welcome back, Sean. I'll give you a good case in point. When Monroe executed the plan of repatriating blacks back to Africa in his presidency, you know, that was something that the Constitution didn't allow for. The states could have, you know, said, hey, that's not good. We, you know, and as a matter of fact, this actually begs the question, because the way I think, the states should actually have mechanisms in holding the government accountable. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so when Monroe actually did that, the state should have determined whether they wanted to impeach him or at least place sanctions or do something to basically point out that what he did may have been morally right, it was unconstitutional, and he needs to suffer some form of justice. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And when we look at the Constitution, the states don't have any mechanism in calling out and saying, hey, you just did something you shouldn't have done. And I think that it would have been kind of hard to do that, other than the fact that this goes to the comments that were made during the ratification debates, as well as in the Federalist Papers, because they were, you know, stitched in, that the states needed to create rules of engagement with each other and saying, we can't allow these types of infractions. And when they occur, we need to talk about what to do. And let's just say we're smart enough to acknowledge, because in the ratification debates, they were very, very clear in articulating this concept that they, the framers, didn't have everything pinned down. And as a matter of fact, when they talked about a Bill of Rights, the Federalists came right back and said, who among us can actually enumerate every right that we want to protect? Because down the road, there may be something else that comes along, like technology, and, oh, we need to, you know, protect your digital footprint. Who knew about a digital footprint? So the point is, it's only an arrogant person that thinks they can create the comprehensive list. The fact is that there needed to be a mechanism amongst the states. They actually needed to have a conversation as what are we going to do or how are we going to interact with each other when they make these types of infractions. That way, the states would then have, you know, rules of engagement when something happened, whether the executive, you know, executed something he shouldn't have done, or the judiciary started doing things like something they shouldn't do, like creating law or what have you, so that they at least had the conversation and created, I'll just say, these portals of communication. Hopefully that all makes sense. So it's always bothered me that there isn't something that's, you know, in the Constitution to basically allow the states to do their job in kind of overseeing what's going on in the Constitution. So with that, now we left off, and you got any questions to move forward? Because we left off with subsection 9 of Section 8. Article 1, Section 8, subsection 9 was the last clause we covered. Anything, any saved rounds? Because we kind of had a little bit of time, but maybe something popped up.
No, sir. I don't see where we had any lingering questions.
Okay. Awesome. Great. So with that, let's go ahead and dive into 10, subsection 10. Now, what we're dealing with right here, because you're going to notice that 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, actually 16 is D.C. So the next five, or actually one, two, three, four, five, there's six. The next six clauses all relate to national security. So, okay, let's go ahead and dive into this first one.
The Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water.
Okay. Any questions on that? Declaring war was left to the federal government. Now, actually, there's a clause in Article 1, Section 10, because it became the common sense point. Well, hold on. What if the states are being harassed? Let's say Congress is not in session. They designed this government to allow Congress to be out of session for long periods of time. This government was a temporary, part-time government that was to kind of function without Congress, without this big cost. And so, what were they to do when Congress wasn't in session? So, Article 1, Section 10 creates the restrictions, but also creates the allowance for the states, if Congress is not in session, where the governor cannot make an appeal, then they have the green light to be able to do what they need to do to defend themselves. Now, I don't know if you remember, because we kind of covered a long time ago, Madison's notes on nullification. And in that document, this really went down this path of what does a state do when the federal government, if the federal government is attacking them? Because it's one thing if foreign governments attack them, they have this, you know, green light to go and get engaged if Congress can't respond because they're not in session. What about the federal government? Because the reality occurred in 1798 when the federal government actually started attacking the states, or actually attacking the citizens of the states by taking away free speech, freedom of the press, so forth and so on. So, you know, Madison and Jefferson created this idea of interposition, or actually they built upon this principle. They didn't create it. The principle existed even during the ratification debates, and they talked about this. But they didn't imagine that they would be so quick to having to utilize this process. So in basically 11 years, actually no, in 10 years, from the day of the ratification to 1798 in the fall, that's basically about 10 years' time when they formed the new government, or was beginning to form the new government. And so we see that at that point, Madison and Jefferson had to organize, and they used Kentucky and Virginia to organize this resistance against the federal government. Now, it caused all sorts of questions because so many people didn't understand the Constitution that Madison had to go out of his way to help educate why this is precisely the legitimate process of what to do. This all conforms to contract law. These are all within those bases. Today, when somebody goes through contract law, they don't get into the details of this because at this point in time, under our legal system, our courts believe that they are the superior body in all things, right?
Yes, they do.
They've assumed pure, full jurisdiction. But in the old days, there were points in time where there was no tribunal greater than the parties to the compact, parties to, you know, that bodied contract that they formed. So it had to be, and they were taught this, that the parties themselves had to become the rightful tribunal to determine what to do regarding the violations of their compact or contract. Ergo, as we can, because in this particular system, this compact, they're creating a subcontractor or an entity to serve them. And if that entity is starting to do things that it shouldn't do, then the parties have to step in. This was the whole principle of interposition. Well, Madison actually took it even further in his notes on nullification, where when the states, because the states needed to actually engage together to interpose. However, if the states are literally under attack by the federal government, where it is causing direct harm, you know, death, loss of property, those types of things, where the federal government is operating in their state outside the boundaries of the Constitution, in other words, assumed powers, then Madison used the term of ultra interposition, where the state needed to do whatever is necessary to defend its sovereignty. And folks, today, there are so many over assertions by the federal government that we're just living with that require that type of ultra interposition, where states need to actually step up and go, BLM, you can't exist here. You have no authority to be possessing these lands or even regulating them. Gone. You're out. And use whatever's necessary to actually, you know, depose them and get them out. That should not, when the state actually steps in, it's one thing for a property owner to stand up and protect his property, because we know exactly what happens. You're going to get killed, because that's what they've been doing. They've been killing us, and they've been basically getting away with murder. The state needs to actually step up and say, look, and the sheriffs, the militia, and, you know, this vestige, the unconstitutional vestige called the National Guard, the governor needs to pull in all resources to say, you're gone. You have no business being here, and we're interposing. You are out now. You can't do these things in our state. All the rest of this, because that does not clean the system. It doesn't wipe the slate clean, right? Right? Because that doesn't mean education isn't being functioned nefariously from D.C. and all these other things. All these, I mean, the webbing and the magnitude of tyranny we're living in is just boggles everybody. When people start realizing it, they go, what are we going to do? We have to take a stand and shut it down. The states have to step in and take, either they take over these things, or these things actually go back to the free market, where, you know, you want to have, you know, money given to you, then you need to marry somebody that has money, or you need to get a job. You know, you actually have to enter into the market space to provide for yourself, because government has no business doing these things. And that even includes states. I've looked at many state constitutions where they don't have the ability to set a minimum wage or even administer welfare. These have all been assumed by the federal government, and they've told the states they need to get on board with this. This is, if you really think about this, Sean, this has been the divine hand of providence, because when the funding goes away, the states are going to look and go, well, how do we do this? And actually, everybody in the state needs to point to the state constitution and go, it doesn't matter what you think. If it's not in that constitution, you can't even do it. You hid behind the federal government in applying these unconstitutional things. Now that they're gone, now that that's gone, you know, you're going to have to be held to that constitution. So, anyway. So declaring war is obviously something that the federal government has to do. Do you understand the granting letters of marquee and reprisal?
Vaguely.
Okay. So granting letters of marque and reprisal basically means that any ship or commerce from a specific nation, you know, becomes fair game. You know, that a person or pirates can go out and capture and bring them in for a bounty or what have you. Letters of marque and reprisal can only be set up by the federal government, not by the states. So in other words, because if a state could do this, then we would actually have, you know, states, you know, instituting these types of things that would lead to war. And they right. didn't want the states to be able to, you know, open those cans of worms. That was really the federal government's job, is to keep us secure and to protect us and make rules concerning captures on land and water, because that kind of goes hand in hand with the letters of marque and reprisal. So anyway, the
that
next one.
Close to
go
home.
Ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, what's that?
I was saying that hits close to home, because we have a local historical legend, Jean Lafitte, who was a privateer.
Okay. So let me
in service of the government. He was a pirate in service of the government.
Okay. So let's look at the drug war just real quick, because this kind of opens up a different problem. So the drug war is actually being executed, and the federal government is going down the path of creating letters of marque and reprisal where they're capturing, but they're not doing it. The Coast Guard, the federal government has their own entities to go out and capture and take these resources and so forth. Technically, they don't have the authority because they created this, you know, this fictitious war on drugs. That's not an enumerated power, right?
Definitely not.
So if a state actually creates a law that says drugs are illegal, it's on the state to enforce that, right?
I would think so.
And if that's the case, then the state actually, if they capture the, you know, these ships and what have you, then that's theirs. Does that make sense? In other words, if those ships come into this the state water, even though the federal government has this international, you know, border boundary that goes 250 miles out, I believe the state, you know, boundary or whatever, you know, they could claim out to 12 miles, something like that. But bottom line, even though the federal government is supposed to be protecting us, they don't have the authority, unless we amend the Constitution, to let them wage warfare over this, the principles of drugs and the commerce, drug commerce throughout the world. So technically, this really falls onto the states, and the states actually probably, if they want to have a war on drugs, they would need to amend the government, either the Constitution, to either let the federal government do it or to free themselves to be able to do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so okay. This granting letters of marque and reprisal doesn't apply to that? Where, like, they're going after the people that are bringing the drugs in by boat?
Well, so when you create that law, then that kind of creates a permanent letter of reprisal and marquee, right? The letters of marquee and reprisal. So in other words, when you say, if you bring anything into our, you know, our boundaries, we will seize, you know, your goods, and we'll seize your property and hold that accountable. Now, because these are foreign states, are they entitled to due process?
I would think not.
No, they're not. And as a matter of fact, you know, they can be thrown in jail, they can just be deported, whatever the state wants to do, because the states are inhibited, or they're hard restricted from exercising due process against United States citizens. In other words, they have to ensure the due process is provided. I'm sorry, I kind of said that wrong. They have to abide by the rights of the citizens who actually have the right of due process. Foreigners don't have that right. And the property rights and everything else, it, you know, this is a foreign nation. And the foreign nation loses everything if they've done something that violates that law, and they know that they're coming in and they're going to lose everything. They do that at that risk. If you really think about it, this would really change, you know, how we would actually, you know, look at this importation of drugs and so forth. But it still wouldn't actually change what we need to, because we need to go down the path of enlightenment using education so that everybody understands that, you know, this is, if you go down this path, you're going to die. You go down this path, here's the empirical data, you take fentanyl, you're going to destroy yourself, you're going to die one way or the other, either by bad health or what have you. And there's plenty of empirical data that kids need to be taught. The education system thinks it's more important to, you know, get them sexual dysphoria and what have you than to understand, you know, these risks that they may be facing. As a matter of fact, if we actually started going down the path of enlightenment, we wouldn't even have to spend that much time with those types of topics in school anymore, because enlightenment an enlightened society embraces discipline. In other words, an enlightened society would not allow practices and behavior that would be counterproductive or destructive to the state and the individual. In other words, if we start going down this path of enlightenment, it actually, if we're doing it right, then we would get to a point where we, you know, it's kind of like this path of ascension, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does make sense. But I think part of the problem is that they've co-opted that mentality for everything, the advertising and the promotion of products. And it might not be drugs and narcotics, but they're advertising things that are detrimental to your life and, you know, making it seem like it's the greatest thing in the world.
Right.
And instead of telling you that it's bad for you, they tell you it's good for you, right, so that they can sell it and make a profit.
Right. Okay, so if we can move on to 11. Now, this one is always misinterpreted, but let's go ahead. Let's dive into this one.
The Congress shall have power to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years.
Okay, so what they did in this idea of being able to create this national defense system to raise and support armies is this tie. If you're going to create the federalized army, then you have to have the appropriation, you know, tied to only 2 years. In other words, you can't do this permanently. That makes sense, right? Okay, so that's the whole point to this clause. This clause doesn't give them carte blanche the power to just create any type of army of mercenaries or what have you. And as a matter of fact, the next couple of lines here, we're actually going to get into what is the process of creating this federalized army. Because it's right there in subsection 14. So let's just dive, because this clause is literally the funding of standing armies. This was really, you know, the standing army clause, that you couldn't do it because it was about funding for 2 years to ensure that the federal government couldn't just create these perpetual wars. Okay, so let's go into the next one.
The Congress shall have power to provide and maintain a Navy.
There you go. And the Navy, the Department of the Navy's job and focus is to protect America from external threats. And back in those days, external threats only came from the sea. If it came from on land, then we had the ability to put, you know, forts, arsenals, and what have you, to have minimal service. But technically, when you look at the interior, who is occupying those forts?
It should be Marines, right?
But no, actually, it should be the militia. Because the militia has the responsibility of safeguarding the homeland. So when you get out into territories, now you have a territory that doesn't have a state, so it doesn't have a militia. So they need to actually have a small cadre or a small element of armed men that are federalized to protect that territory until that territory becomes a state and functions with its own militia protecting itself. That should be the criteria of a state becoming a state. And that was a big problem because Congress had every intent in maintaining a standing army so that they could keep these people employed and just start, you know, expanding this massive army going across the United States. This is why when states joined the Union, the federal government actually, you know, by 1816... And this was in the early, we're going into break here in just a second. So in 1816, this was Indiana. So they didn't get too far west into the western expanse. I mean, Louisiana was already part of the Union along the border, or I should say the Gulf Coast. And I think Florida, I could look it up. But anyway, let's go into the break. And when we come back, we'll talk about, you know, this admission of states and how they literally manipulated the states into not creating their own militia. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so when the territories were in the process of being prepared to become a state, Congress created some basic rules, but they completely obviated or they completely forgot about the militia. In other words, when a state joined the Union, the cavalry stayed in the state because Indians were present or this imminent danger and so forth. And the rules that they created were you have to have 60,000 people to create a state, and you have to, you know, they have to be certain percentage of Christian, certain percentage of, you know, speaking English, those types of things. But for the most part, they didn't have a requirement of a fully functioning, capable militia to take charge as it became a state. You would think that that would have been imperative because the state had to provide bodies for the militia for the national defense. Does that make sense? And so when we get through, I don't understand
how they could have just that early in the process, how did they get away from that requirement?
Well, so as we started going more and more to the West, America, and you got to remember, in 1816 in Indiana, Indiana became a state. The only other state in the Northwest Territory that actually became a state by that point in time was Ohio. And Ohio, I mean, if you really look at it, it's right there next to Pennsylvania. And so even though, you know, in 1816, Indiana came into the state, it came into the state post the Ghent Treaty, the Treaty of Ghent. Which means that by this point in time, we had secured ourselves from harassment and future engagements with the British forces. We finally beat the British, and we finally had this level of peace, and this concept of manifest destiny was just around the corner. And so we see how Congress was more concerned about getting states quickly into the Union than they were about the militia, and this is why. When a state joins the Union, Congress is that's when they can lay out apportionment for taxation, because a territory is not subject to taxation, only states. The states receive representation and they are taxed. A territory may have a guest in Congress, but they have no vote, so they don't really have any apportionment and representation, and they don't pay taxes. Now, when we actually look at the other part of the state or the responsibility of the state, as it's supposed to have its own militia, guess who has to pay for that?
States.
No, the federal government.
Oh, that's right. That's right. They have to provide.
And so when we go through these things, you'll actually see how it is, you know, a good business decision to say, we're just going to manage this instead of we paying you to, you know, train everybody. We already got people trained. We can just cut through the chase. And so when we get into this, you're actually going to see how the states were literally being bypassed because they were bringing in mercenaries. They were bringing people from other states into their state and maintaining a residency, and they were training and promoting and all of that type of stuff, which the state was supposed to possess. They were supposed to do all of that. They would be the appointing of officers and all of that. So let's just keep moving forward. But the point is that, you know, they had this responsibility of providing for the Navy. That was the National Force, or I should say the Strategic Protection Force. Now, the next one, subsection 13, this is one of the very few that's not being violated. Go ahead.
The Congress shall have power to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces.
There you go. So they didn't call it an army at that point. They just called it land forces because it goes under this, you know, this umbrella or this the auspices that this is a federalized militia that becomes the army, because this next one is how they actually form the army. Go ahead. This is subsection 14.
I have power to provide for the calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasion.
Okay, so one of the things that really concerned the states is the ability for creating a standing army where the federal government would then just permanently start creating this law enforcement agency. Now, the way in law enforcement, federal laws were to be enforced was a cooperation between the federal marshals and the sheriffs, that, you know, they would make sure that collecting taxes or those types of things were managed and administered by the states, because they did not want federal enforcement agencies, mercenaries, taking up residency within their state but not being loyal to the state itself. The whole concept of using the militia to enforce the federal laws within the state were literally getting the people to protect themselves from federal tyranny. This is the ultimate check on government, where if the federal government says we're going to create this law and now you got to enforce this, well, that goes to the state militia in actually stepping up and having to enforce the law. The only reason the federal government would federalize the militia to do this is if states are resistant, like Pennsylvania. We've talked about this before, where Western Pennsylvania, with the Whiskey Rebellion, they revolted. It required, you know, interaction with the federalized militia, and that's exactly what they did. But if the states are actually doing and enforcing the law, using their militia to do that, then they don't need to federalize it. The whole point of using the militia was one, as you just listed them. And so technically, the only way and the only reason the army is to be formed is for these three purposes: to execute the laws, to suppress insurrections, and to repel invasions. There's nowhere here where it says we're going to go protect our friends in Europe.
Right.
There's nowhere here where it mentions that, you know, we need to, you know, have destabilizers and a presence, you know, sitting around the world so that people behave better. The army, or I should say,
commercial interests.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, going through the militia debates throughout the ratification debates, you'll see that the states were very wary in allowing their militia to be deployed into other states. They didn't like the idea that, you know, Maine could actually be deployed down to Florida. And these were really stupid arguments, because technically, when you're deploying forces, you want to, you know, keep your costs down to where you don't have to move forces that far. So you want to call forth, if the problem is Florida, then you want to call forth Alabama, you know, militia, the Georgia militia, the local regional area. Not call them from, you know, all the, you know, far corners of the nation. It wouldn't make sense that they would do that. If they did that, it would tip everybody off going, what the heck are they doing? Why are they taking our militia to go suppress this?
Strategically, it makes no sense as well.
But
especially in those days.
Right. As you see the process of what and why and how, it actually constantly begged the question or the check on government using these forces to, you know, to get their way. So in other words, this militia was a righteous check on our government. And so the intent of getting rid of it became very obvious. They were just going to ignore doing that. Okay, so for them to form the army, this, they only had these three reasons. They had to, you know, say, okay, we need to repel an invasion. And that's exactly what we need to do for federalizing the militia today, is to repel the millions and millions of invaders in America that are creating all sorts of havoc, economic havoc, housing havoc, health havoc. Anyway, so that's the forming. That is the process of forming that army that they mentioned above that would require appropriation first. So in other words, now that they're going to call forth, guess what they have to do now that they've gotten to this point of calling forth the militia and forming the army? They already have to have a bill, a part of that calling forth the militia to fund it for whatever the purpose is. Does that make sense now?
Yes.
Okay. So that's why 11 and 14 are interjoined, why 11 needed to state that, hey, you can form and, you know, create these armies, but you need to, you know, pay for it with the proper appropriations. And then, okay, this is how and the reasons why they formed that army. The next one actually talks about the responsibility of states having the militia and who has what responsibilities. So let's go ahead and read this next one, 15.
The Congress shall have power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia.
Okay, let's stop right there. Let's just stop right there, because obviously that highlighted part is something very specific that is a role and responsibility for the federal government, because it says Congress shall have the power to provide. They shall have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining. In other words, they actually have to provide the arms, the weaponry, the munition, right? You see that? The arming? They're funding the militia. And not only that, but the disciplining. What is the disciplining? It's not the UCMJ, the disciplining.
Practices.
There you go, the training, the education in how to be an infantryman in the U.S. Army, you know, or I should say in the federal army, that all states need to have this. But it basically lays out that the money comes from the federal government to organize, arm, and discipline. So in other words, the training comes from the federal government. And then it says, and for governing such part, keep going, you go ahead and take it from there.
And for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress.
Okay, so this last clause actually has two little components to it. So the federal government has this responsibility of governing such part of them as while they're unemployed. In other words, while they've been federalized, they are being governed, and come to find out, the president's the commander-in-chief, while they're in the service of the United States. Reserving to the states, now here's the caveat, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers. So let me ask you this. Out of the federalized army today, how many appointments for officers, you know, these generals, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, how many of those appointments have come from the states?
I think probably only in the National Guard.
Imagine what?
Only in the National Guard does that happen.
Correct? Yeah, so so what they did...
The State Guards. So it doesn't happen in the army.
Right, so what they did was, because they weren't supposed to create a standing army, but what they did was they passed the Dick Act. The Dick Act basically says, we're taking over the militia functions and the management and control. In other words, see, when we went through the ratification debates, we pointed out that the militia in the Virginia debates pointed out that they were to deploy and basically have a militia for every county, and that the counties would have an apportionment that would be based on the population. So if you had a large population county, then you would have a good percentage of the militia. because you'd need to execute the laws and, you know, keep order and that stuff. In other words, our enforcement and policing was to be done by we the people. They actually integrated a system that the states could have quickly used and actually, you know, created this very good, neat, beautiful system. It may have been a little, you know, I wouldn't even think it would be elaborate. But if you kind of look at how Israel has, you know, been defending itself, and I mean, everybody, even women, you know, are pulled into it. But ours, I think, was even more divine because, you know, everybody had a part. Everybody should be a part of it when it comes to local enforcement. The federalizing may be something different, but they had a responsibility to execute the laws of the states and the counties, right? Why create a mercenary force instead of using the militia? I will tell you why. Because if you create a mercenary force, they will do what you tell them to. If you use the militia, these people will say, hey, I don't think this is right. You know, you're asking me to enforce some pretty ugly laws, you know, on my neighbors over here where I know they're good people and they don't deserve this. You see my point?
Oh, absolutely. We lived it firsthand during Katrina.
There you go.
Yeah, Blackwater mercenaries coming in and disarming people in their homes.
In their homes. And see, that was all unconstitutional. And, you know, what would have happened? Or was there any outbreak of fire and hostilities where people were getting killed?
No, there wasn't anything like that. There was a couple of people that resisted and they ended up getting detained or whatever. But, you know, they were just standing on principle. But there wasn't any gunplay or violence, you know, over it.
But taking their guns was a huge...
That it was actually happening, that we had mercenaries, in the streets going house to house.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so taking their guns, that's a huge violation of the Constitution.
Correct.
Huge.
And this wasn't even in... I mean, and there was a bunch, it was just 25th anniversary, and we had a bunch of documentaries come out about different things that occurred during then. Uh-huh. And like the police were overreaching all over the place. They murdered a couple of people in the heat of the moment, and they just had a total disregard for civil rights. And they were under the assumption that they were operating under martial law when it was never declared. But the mercenaries were confiscating weapons in areas that weren't even devastated. I mean, they didn't have power and stuff, but they were just, it was more like it was a test of what they could get away with.
Right. And so here's another thing. They laid out the power to declare martial law could only be declared where the militia was deployed. They couldn't create these standing armies. They couldn't create these mercenary forces. So in other words, the fact that they've done this is one, unconstitutional, they've created these mercenary forces. Secondly, if they want to declare martial law, they have to deploy the militia, and they can only declare martial law to the area where the militia have been deployed, where it's necessary. They made it impossible in this Constitution to declare martial law for every state, every person in the United States. They couldn't do it. They can't do it under the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And no, most people don't know this. This is one of the reasons why when the pandemic, because I've read by this point in time in 2020 when the pandemic was being visible. I mean, I remember hearing about it in August or September, and then it became, you know, a real discussion in the news in November. You know, in what this was all happening in China first, and seeing what was playing out and hearing the mantra for the past 20 years out of the Bush Obama administration and then the Trump administration, there was no doubt in my mind that they were getting ready to unleash, you know, a deployed pandemic. So I wrote an article, What is the Real Problem? And I wrote that prior to the pandemic as a trying to get people to, you know, unite on the Constitution instead of their myopic agendas. The next one I actually wrote was actually in January because we saw the COVID was coming here, and I actually wrote because I thought it was necessary to write a martial law in the 21st century so that everybody would know how martial law was defined in the Constitution or in the ratification debates, how it was stipulated to the states. The fact that we have that is how it has to be followed. So anyway, I wrote that, and then I saw this as we're going into February and the discussion of possibly shutting down and the call to shut down states. The next article I wrote was the unseen teeth in the Constitution, where each of these articles was helping educate people that they can't do these things. And that third article helped everybody understand that no state can pass any law that abridges the privileges and immunities, because it seemed like Trump wasn't going to do it. He was going to call upon the states to do it. Well,
right. That's what I was going to say.
And so because the states can't do it, if everybody understood that, they would have been able to hold their people accountable. So anyway, so those three articles were kind of done. And then I did my Why Counties Matter Most, which is the fourth, and then this last one. I've got the Federalist Paper article coming out. But anyway, let's get back to this. So they are to provide for the arming, organizing, disciplining, and reserving to the states this appointment of officers. In addition to that, when it comes to the training, the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So in other words, the states are the ones that actually have to have their own school for infantrymen. In other words, each state is to have its own education system in ensuring that their militia is being trained prior to them being called. When we look at the military training today, yeah, they've made it far cheaper by having it in just different points in the United States, but they're not abiding by this. In other words, prior to a child graduating and becoming 17 years of age, they should be ready to actually serve in the militia, right?
Yes, sir.
And so when we look at this, this is the only part of the Constitution that talks about training or education for the states. The one thing that the federal government is to fund the education for the states, they're supposed to be funding that for the militia and the militia alone. And why do we have such extensive curriculum that's being driven by the federal government that's not, none of it is for the militia? Ah, now we can start seeing that everything has been done in a way to basically disarm us, to basically make us, more dependent on them, more fearful, and so forth. So as they've played these, I'll just say these psyops, these games, they've completely, manipulated us into these positions. And all of it is unconstitutional. So, any questions or anything before?
I was just wondering, because when I look back at the history of conflict in the United States, uh-huh, to where we were in conflict with different nations,
yeah,
it seems like at every turn there wasn't very much time in between, major conflict. We had the conflicts going on with Native Americans. We had conflicts going on with Spain over Mexico. We had the War of 1812. We had, the French. So, I mean, how much did that play into this being obfuscated?
Well, if you talk to a military history buff, and right, if they actually had the fine tuning of the Constitution, you'll actually find that when we got into the late 1800s, after post-Civil War, the United States Army was being deployed off of U.S. soil. The Rough Riders, Teddy Roosevelt was a part of the Rough Riders, right?
Correct.
Did they not deploy to Havana, Cuba?
Yes, they did.
And they deployed through the Banana Wars and so forth. As a matter of fact, I think we even deployed the Marines. Now, the Marines is one thing, but I don't know if the army was also deployed into China in the Boxer Rebellion. So when you really start looking at, you know, all these little skirmishes, at what point did they finally say, because I will tell you it was the Civil War, where they finally said, we have basically made the militia system incompetent and inept. We haven't been training them, and we haven't been using them. And now that Lincoln called forth the militia, and the militia wasn't willing to fight his war, he dismissed them and on his own formed his own federalized mercenary force. All unconstitutional. Almost everything Lincoln did was unconstitutional. I mean, I'd have to actually look at every step and everything he declared, called for, and so forth. But almost everything he did was unconstitutional. And yet there are, you know, people on both sides of the party system that look at him as, you know, just this glorious man. As a matter of fact, I saw recently where there was a video comparing and basically connecting the likenesses of Lincoln and his presidency to John F. Kennedy. So, as I, you know, look at Lincoln, all the different presidents and so forth, I think that was the point where the militia, they basically put the death nail into the militia because Lincoln just completely abandoned it. And from that point forward, they started playing these games. And by the time the Dick Act of 1903 came out, the states were already not providing the militia. They needed to do this Dick Act because they knew that the World War was coming. Because Roosevelt and the tensions and so forth were, you know, kind of focused at home. And I think Taft was not progressive enough, which is one of the reasons why Roosevelt came back in after his first term, after Taft's first term, and said, this guy's not progressive enough. I'm going to challenge him. And by so doing, it guaranteed Wilson that presidency. It's the exact same thing that played out with Bush and Perot in letting Clinton, ensuring Clinton became the president. And Clinton was so unfavored by the nation. The first presidency, do you know what the popular vote was for 92, that election? 39%. Yeah. Clinton got 39% of the national vote. And in the second election against Bob Dole, do you know what the popular vote was? 42%. So in other words, they needed Perot to come back and challenge Bob Dole to ensure that the bad guy, the guy that they needed to further the cause of globalism into the game, was in the game. And ergo, that's why we, you know, have this. That's why we're in this situation. We've ran out of time. So when we come back, we will actually pick this all up again. And if you have any questions, Sean, just let me know at the beginning of the next session or this next show, and we will address those and keep moving forward. But folks, we're laying it out here. What is constitutional? What isn't constitutional? And we're actually reading this, and I hope you're garnering the importance of constitutional compliance. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.